Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture sponsored by the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts at Boston University. Speaking will be 2007 Luce Visiting Assistant Professor Dr. Kristen Schwain. Dr. Schwain's lecture is titled Modernity's Usable Past, James Weldon Johnson, Aaron Douglas, and Charles B. Fall's God's Trombones. We begin with an introduction by Luce Program Director Peter Hawkins.
I'd like to introduce you to Kristen Schwain. Kristen was educated at Valparaiso University in Indiana and at Stanford, where she did a joint PhD in art history and humanities. Since 2001, she's been assistant professor of American art at the University of Missouri, Columbia, where she's also associated faculty in the Department of Religion. She's been a researcher at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, at the Smithsonian Institution, and the Stanford Humanities Center. There have been prizes and awards along the way, and come the autumn, there will be a book from Cornell University Press, Signs of Grace, Religion and American Art in the Gilded Age. The courses she's teaching for us this semester are Introduction to the Visual Culture of American Religions and Word and Image in American Religions. Left by chance at the Luce office printer, Professor Schwain's class notes for a presentation on the iconography of African-American Bible quilts. Formal analysis of quilts. Attention paid to materials, to the processes of stitching or piecework, to the question of dimension, to issues of workmanship. And then readings or decodings of some of Harriet Power's quilt iconography, with help from Penofsky, his notions of conventional and intrinsic meanings. How I wished I could have been a student in that classroom on January 29th. And so I've done the next best thing. I brought you a one-off Kristen Schwain lecture this evening entitled Modernity's Usable Pasts, James Weldon Johnson, Aaron Douglas, and Charles B. Fall's God's Trombones. Kristen Schwain.
Well, thank you very much for that warm introduction. My talk tonight represents the beginnings of a new project, one that investigates the role of folk art in the formation of modern American art and national identity in the interwar years. For this reason, I am both a little uneasy and quite excited. Apprehensive because I am confident many of you know far more about these subjects than I, and enthusiastic because your expertise and questions will undoubtedly enrich my investigation in new and unforeseen ways. In 1927, the African-American author, diplomat, and songwriter James Weldon Johnson published a series of poems intended to preserve the sermons of old-time Negro preachers before they vanished from the American scene. Part of Johnson's larger project of assembling and conserving African-American folk creations of all kinds, God's Trombones includes a preface that historicizes the antebellum minister and eight poems predicated on his oratory and theology. The opening prayer and seven sermons are accompanied by lettering fashioned by one of the nation's leading illustrators, Charles B. Falls, and images produced by one of the foremost visual artists of the Harlem Renaissance, Aaron Douglas. The book met with immediate critical acclaim. The president of Tuskegee Institute described it as a glorious treasure in which there is not a flaw. American poet Joseph Auslander declared it the most significant contribution to Afro-American poetry that has been made in many a moon. And H.L. Mencken called Go Down Moses, a poem included in the collection, as one of the most remarkable and moving poems of its type ever written in America. A New York Times critic encapsulated the opinions of many when he exclaimed, "There is sensitivity, artistic judgment, and a sustained emotional beauty in Johnson's work. This brief glimpse into the contemporary reception of God's trombones underscores how it focused primarily on Johnson's poetry, although Douglas's visual contributions were generally cited and an illustration often accompanied a review or advertisement. Recent scholarship has continued this trend with few exceptions, analyzing the book's component parts independently of one another and ignoring the lettering altogether. This evening, I will approach God's trombones as a material artifact in order to examine the interplay between and among Johnson's poems, Fall's typography, and Douglas's illustrations. I do so for at least three reasons. First, because their interaction is central to achieving Johnson's explicit goal, cited in the introduction, of resurrecting the antebellum preacher. Second, multimedia works like this one were common throughout the Harlem Renaissance, but have rarely been studied as objects in and of themselves. A richer understanding of this period is predicated on examining its social, political, and aesthetic production on its own terms, not those determined by our disciplinary commitments. Third and finally, it sets into sharp relief the complications and tensions that arose from the book's implicit goals of constructing a usable past and celebrating an African-American spirit. Indeed, the traditions and legacies selected by cultural producers as the true origins of modern America bore the heavy burden of evoking an authentic, transcendent, and essential spirit, as well as representing evolutionary and historical change. Somehow, they were to do this simultaneously. The years between the two world wars were characterized by a widespread search for an authentic national culture. In his influential essay of 1918, literary critic Van Wyck Brooks called on intellectuals to discover, invent a usable past, to create a storehouse of apt attitudes and adaptable ideals, cultural traditions and spiritual resources that contemporary artists could draw upon to forge a collective American identity. Folk art, broadly defined during this period as the unconscious expression of the common people, was central to this enterprise because it was seen to present both the innate characteristics and the evolution of a race. It embodied a people's spiritual essence and exemplified its historical progress. Consequently, culture brokers located America's heritage in the customs they believe constituted the nation's proper artistic and racial genealogy. Five brief examples highlight the range of cultures and objects they selected. First, musicologists and folk collectors, ranging in kind from Harvard professor Francis James Child, who cataloged the presence and mutations of British folk songs in the United States, to the father and son team of John and Alan Lomax, who traversed 300 miles throughout the South recording and archiving local music, they found America's true heritage in the Anglo-Saxon ballads of Appalachia. Artists like Marsden Hartley looked to Native American cultures to uncover what Hartley termed the poetic aspects of our original land, asserting that the red man is the one truly indigenous religionist and aesthete of America. Georgia O'Keeffe found a source for her embodied formalism in the Spanish Catholic cultures of the Southwest, along with photographs of the Penitente Morada and crosses that stood only a stone's throw from her home in Abiquiu. Charles Sheeler's Home Sweet Home, in contrast, culled from the clean lines of Shaker furniture, graphic signs and symbols of the Pennsylvania Dutch, and geometry of New England textiles to root his precisionist aesthetic in New England. And finally, regionalist artists looked to communal rituals, like full immersion baptism, to locate the nation's roots in the rural American scene, as well as in stories of individual survival amid natural disasters and difficulties. As these examples indicate, discovering a cultural heritage was not a neutral process. Culture brokers selected traditions they believe constituted the nation's proper artistic and racial inheritance. Like their contemporaries, James Weldon Johnson and other African-American intellectuals searched for a usable past that proffered a vision of the nation's future. Unlike the others, they put forward creations of antebellum slave life in the South as distinctly American forms. Johnson wrote, on a number of occasions, "What the colored poet in the United States needs is something like what Synge did for the Irish. He needs to find a form that will express the racial spirit by symbols from within, rather than by symbols from without." He asserted that while influenced by African traditions, sermons, spirituals, and folktales were forged in direct response to the circumstances of slave life, and therefore were authentically American products. Importantly, critic and philosopher Alain Locke stressed that recognizing black art as quintessentially American and historicizing the spirit of a race were not inherently contradictory or divergent projects. He wrote, "America seeking a new spiritual expansion and artistic maturity, trying to found an American literature, a national art, and national music, implies a Negro American culture seeking the same satisfaction and objectives." While the historical record suggests that few white critics were willing to consider black achievement in aesthetic rather than sociological terms, let alone ponder it as a legitimate foundation for a genuine American art, these goals nevertheless guided much African American intellectual and artistic production in the interwar years. In God's Trombones, Johnson heeded the call for the new Negro to remake his past in order to make his future. Concerned that the old-time preacher was getting lost amid the preservation efforts surrounding sacred and secular songs, plantation tales, and dances, Johnson sought to resurrect the antebellum sermon. He was inspired by the sermons he heard as a child in the South, particularly those predicated on a template modified by individual preachers, like the well-known Train Sermon, The Valley of Dry Bones, and The Heavenly March. He drew, too, on the legacy of John Jasper, a well-known Baptist pastor from Richmond, Virginia, who was known to attract thousands of black and white people to a sermon that proved the earth is flat and the sun does move. More immediately, he was motivated by the specific performance of an unnamed orator in Kansas City, who electrified, in his words, an apathetic and dozing crowd. Rather than spinning his oratory from a single biblical verse like the models mentioned above, this unnamed preacher performed another genre of antebellum oration that, according to Johnson, began with creation, went on to the fall of man, rambled through the trials and tribulations of the Hebrew children, came down to the redemption by Christ, and ended with the judgment day and a warning and an exhortation to sinners. Johnson even went so far as to describe the scene. The preacher strode the pulpit up and down in what was actually a very rhythmic dance, and he brought into play the full gamut of his wonderful voice. A voice, what shall I say? Not of an organ or a trumpet, but rather of a trombone, the instrument possessing above all others the power to express the wide and varied range of emotions encompassed by the human voice, and with greater amplitude. He intoned, he moaned, he pleaded, he blared, he crashed, he thundered. I sat fascinated, and more, I was, perhaps against my will, deeply moved. The emotional effect upon me was irresistible. The structure of God's Trombones employs the format of the general sermon that so moved Johnson that day in Kansas. After opening with a prayer, Johnson takes the reader on a journey that winds from the Old Testament to the Gospels to Revelations to local customs and back again. The creation is followed by the prodigal son, go down death, a funeral sermon, Noah built the ark, the crucifixion, let my people go, and finally, the judgment day. Because Johnson considered the antebellum minister as much an orator as a theologian, he wanted the poems to reproduce his rhetorical style, as well as the interactive religious environment he helped to create. Telling readers the sermons would be better intoned than read, Johnson attempted to transpose the tempo of the preacher through the poem's line arrangements. Pauses or inhalations through the inclusion of dashes, and syncopated speech through the crowding or lengthening of syllables. His frequent quoting of the spirituals intimated further the speaker's cadence as well as the congregant's response. For example, he ends the crucifixion with echoes of the popular spiritual, "Were you there when they crucified my Lord?" "Oh, I tremble, yes, I tremble. It causes me to tremble, tremble when I think how Jesus died. Died on the steeps of Calvary, how Jesus died for sinners, sinners like you and me." In addition, Johnson relied on repetition and onomatopoeia to place readers at the biblical event. And again, I'm quoting from the crucifixion. On Calvary, they crucified my Jesus. They nailed him to the cruel tree, and the hammer, the hammer, the hammer rang through Jerusalem streets. The hammer, the hammer, the hammer rang through Jerusalem streets. By explaining how to recite the poems, calling on familiar musical compositions, and deploying figurative language, Johnson enabled the reader to hear the preacher's voice and imagine the wider scene. A congregation responding emotionally and physically to the minister's words, swinging their heads and bodies and answering in harmony like, as he put it, a rolling sea. In addition to mining the form and the performative nature of the old-time sermon, Johnson remained true to its theology by presenting God as a human being who intervenes in the lives of believers, and by identifying African-American slaves with God's chosen people and their experience in slavery with the Exodus story. For example, Johnson begins the series of poetic sermons with a human and alienated God in the creation. "And God stepped out on space, and he looked around and said, 'I'm lonely. I'll make me a world.'" Later, in Let My People Go, Johnson anthropomorphizes God leading the Hebrew children out of Egypt and describes the Pharaoh and his army as overseers and drivers, merging the biblical past with plantation life. In both ways, Johnson echoed the structure of the antebellum sermon by situating the biblical text within its scriptural and historical context and relating it to current realities. By invoking a God who acted in history and worked on behalf of the oppressed, enslaved Americans found meaning in the past and confidence their Christian faith would lead to spiritual and political freedom. Importantly, Johnson's language and figurative imagery underscores his equation of African American folk culture with Southern slave life. As you may have noticed from my reading of his poems, Johnson did not use traditional dialect or formal English in his writings. He did so for two reasons, one social and one historical. First, Johnson asserted that dialect was too burdened by connotations of pathos and humor to serve as an effective tool for Black expression, at least at that particular historical moment. Second, and I think more creatively, he argued that old-time preachers spoke a fusion of Negro idioms with Bible English. When they preached, he said, they left traditional dialect behind and invoked what he described as the sublime phraseology of the Hebrew prophets and steeped in the idioms of King James English. Regardless, the vernacular offered Johnson an important alternative, allowing him to avoid the limitations of dialect, but nonetheless evoke mental images drawn specifically from African American culture. For example, he ends the creation by comparing God or imaging God as a mammy. "Up from the bed of the river, God scooped the clay, and by the bank of the river, he kneeled him down. And there the great God Almighty, who lit the sun and fixed it in the sky, who flung the stars to the farmost corner of the night, who rounded the earth in the middle of his hand, the great God, like a mammy bending over her baby, kneeled down in the dust, toiling over a lump of clay till he shaped it in his own image." Johnson underscores the antebellum South as source of American and African-American folk culture by locating his poems there quite literally. For example, the second stanza of the creation reads, "As far as the eye of God could see, darkness covered everything, blacker than 100 midnights down in a cypress swamp." Cypress swamp being the key geological form there, I guess you would say. Johnson also situated many of his human protagonists in the region. In Go Down Death, a funeral sermon, Johnson writes, "And God said, go down, death, go down. Go down to Savannah, Georgia, down to Yamacra, and find Sister Carrie." Yamacra might sound familiar to some of you because it was one of the areas in coastal Georgia and South Carolina where oral folklore was collected as part of the WPA's writers program in the 1930s. And Nora and Zora Neale Hurston may have been one of the people who was collecting there. Fall's lettering for God's Trombones reinforced Johnson's desire to root the presence of the African-American preacher in the historical record. Charles B. Fall's had 30 years of experience illustrating and embellishing books when he created the lettering for God's Trombones. He began his career on the staff of the Chicago Tribune and publishing illustrations for Echo at the end of the 19th century. After moving to New York City, Falls was commissioned to illustrate and decorate books, which led to a career embellishing print ephemera of all kind. During this, what has been called by scholars as the golden age of American illustration, Falls was perhaps best well known for his 1923 collection of woodcuts, ABC Book. Perhaps influenced, though, by the success of God's Trombones, he produced his own representation of the Christmas story as a gift book 2 years later, deploying a similar, though more traditional and elaborate, Gothic font. Fall's lettering situated God's Trombones within the Western Christian tradition and American visual culture, while at the same time emphasizing the book's performative nature. By fashioning a calligraphic font for the book's titles, replete with ornate capitals, varied thick and thin strokes, and elegant flourishes, Falls positions the book within the tradition of medieval manuscript illumination. The evocation of gold leaf in the type's deep yellow hue and its age through the craquelicure on the binding further the association of God's Trombones with Christianity's long history, as well as its intellectual and devotional traditions. More immediately, Falls drew on the intimate association between the Gothic style, Christianity, and middle-class values that permeated American material culture in the second half of the 19th century. And a scholar of material culture, Kenneth Ames, has shown how the degree to which Gothic lettering really did permeate all areas of American life, not only in terms of house decoration, in which the Gothic style became a very popular model for home building in mid-century, but also in artifacts like graduation certificates, baptismal certificates, and in the very, very popular perforated cardboard motto sampler. What we find in American culture in the late part of the period, and this association which certainly they're all drawing on, is that domesticity, sentimentality, Christianity all kind of became embodied in the Gothic lettering. At the same time, however, the lettering's playfulness, stylized geometry, and elongated forms calls attention to its modernity. Fall's angled and uneven placement of characters and unbracketed hairline serifs even create the impression of half and whole notes on a musical staff, reiterating Johnson's attention to how the reader should intone the poems. Moreover, the font's angularity, dynamic use of diagonal lines, and dramatic juxtapositions of long and short, thick and thin, echo Douglas's visual style. Fall's words, as images, connect Johnson's text and Douglas's images, tradition and modernity. While Johnson's preface and sermons and Fall's calligraphic lettering work to present and legitimize the old-time preacher within Christian history, Douglas's distinctly modern illustrations applied the messages to contemporary African-American life. When Johnson invited Douglas to illustrate for God's Trombones, the visual artist was well known to the African American community through his work in two of the leading publications of the new Negro Renaissance, The Crisis, or the official organ of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and Opportunity, the publication of the National Urban League. He was known, too, for his contribution to Alain Locke's groundbreaking anthology, The New Negro, and his illustrations for other high-profile writers, like Langston Hughes. In other words, Douglas was an emerging player in Harlem's artistic, intellectual, and political elite. Douglas's work for God's Trombones is characteristic of his signature style. Facing the title page of the corresponding poem, Douglas's images feature thick black outlines that frame the cubist and Art Deco-inspired compositions. Modulations in tone indicate movement, shadow, and dimension in otherwise two-dimensional works. The figures' heads are shown in profile while their bodies appear in three-quarter view, their African features underscored through the artist's loose quotation of Egyptian art. Douglas's representation of the figures as black visually integrated African Americans into the biblical narrative and enabled him to visualize the form of the antebellum sermon by conflating past and present biblical figures and contemporary African Americans. In The Crucifixion, Douglas presents a number of scenes from Johnson's sermons and the Passion, including Christ's betrayal in the Garden of Gethsemane and struggle on the road to Golgotha. A large figure, buckling under the weight and pressure of the cross, lunges on the earth's horizon and dominates the image. He represents simultaneously three different protagonists: Simon of Cyrene, an African man asked to carry Christ's cross; Jesus, the primary subject of the poem; and contemporary African Americans who identified themselves with both men because of their persecution and suffering. The multivalency of the figure is intensified by its visual associations with other human figures in Douglas's illustrations, as well as the widespread equation of the crucified Savior with lynching victims in contemporary American visual culture. I should note here, too, that while few African American leaders called for the visual depiction of a black Christ at the end of the 19th century, the appeal took on greater urgency in the opening decades of the 20th century and became almost standard practice in the 1930s. However, Douglas's representation of Christ here as black is relatively novel, I think. While Johnson's poems located African American history in the antebellum South, Douglas's images focus more on northern urban life. For example, Listen, Lord, a Prayer is predicated on an earlier image that appeared in a volume of Opportunity that featured a series of articles on the spirituals. Directly referencing a spiritual of the same name, Douglas's I Couldn't Hear Nobody Pray in Opportunity spotlights an African-American man's appeal to God, who appears in the upper left corner. In his reformulation of the work for God's Trombones, Douglas replaced the figure of God with shining rays of light to organize the composition. More importantly in this case, Douglas removed the male figure from his southern location, intimated by a log cabin in the background, and his religious community, represented by three additional figures in the foreground. The artist's simplified composition for God's Trombones emphasized an individual's personal relationship with the divine, a formulation more in keeping with Douglas's own spiritual interests and modern religious belief more generally than the worship services of the antebellum slaves. A more direct example of the artist's focus on urban life is his interpretation of Johnson's The Prodigal Son. Johnson's poem portrays a young man's migration from the rural South to the urban North, retelling the parable through the experience of the Great Migration and the Book of Revelations. Johnson writes, "And the younger son kept traveling along, till at nighttime he came to a city. And the city was bright in the nighttime like day, the streets all crowded with people, brass bands and string bands a-playing, and everywhere the young men turned, There was a singing and laughing and dancing. And he stopped a passerby and he said, "Tell me what city is this?" And the passerby laughed and said, "Don't you know? This is Babylon, Babylon, that great city of Babylon. Come on, my friend, and go along with me." And the young man joined the crowd. Douglas literalizes the connection between Babylon and Harlem in the accompanying image, depicting a man and two women dancing underneath the lights that create an eternal day, surrounded by vices that threaten people in the urban north. Now, Douglas's image for the parable had a previous incarnation as an illustration for a poem by Langston Hughes. The two artists were spotlighted in the October 1926 volume of Opportunity, in which Douglas provided images for five of Hughes' poems. These short poems, written in dialect, address the hardships, struggles, and dark underbelly of contemporary black life in the urban north. Douglas's image, My Bad Luck Card, accompanying Hughes's Hard Luck. "'Cause you don't love me is awful, awful hard. Gypsy done showed me my bad luck card. There ain't no good left in this world for me. Gypsy done told me, unlucky as can be. I don't know what poor weary me can do. Gypsy says I'd kill myself if I was you." Certainly there are important differences between these two images. The central male figure in My Bad Luck Card is joined by two women in The Prodigal Son, and the large card that dominates the latter is joined by all the other temptations in the latter. More importantly, however, is the way in which a very similar images can be used in two completely different contexts. Hughes's poem concentrates on elements of folk religion and daily life that many black elites sought to wash over, undermine in the name of uplift. Johnson's poem indeed emphasizes the path out of superstition and temptation. He writes, "Young man, come away from Babylon, the hell border city of Babylon. Leave that dancing and gambling of Babylon, the wine and whiskey of Babylon, the hot-mouthed women of Babylon. Fall down on your knees and say in your heart, I will arise and go to my father." Douglas's illustrations proved adaptable because rather than wrestling with antebellum folk culture, he looked to African art for his historical precedents. In The Legacy of the Ancestral Arts, Alain Locke argued that African art provided black Americans with the visual idiom that could avoid stereotypical depictions of black people, influence the production of an internationally renowned modern art, and generate a locally and a racially representative tradition. Douglas echoed Locke's point of view in a 1927 interview. "We can go to African life and get a certain amount of understanding, form, and color, and use this knowledge in development of an expression which interprets our life." Douglas's reliance on African art served a similar purpose to Johnson's dependence on the folk. Both turned to the primitive to create histories particular to African Americans that provided a foundation for race pride and emphasized the new Negro's modern consciousness and progressive development. God's Trombones participated in the Negro Renaissance mandate to prove African-American equality through the maturity of their fine art production. The poetry, lettering, and illustrations worked together to incarnate the form and content of the Antebellum Sermon through three very different historical traditions. Johnson relied on Southern folk productions, Falls on domestic and devotional imagery, and Douglas on African art, all rooting, in other words, their contributions to an American identity in a particular usable past. In doing so, they linked the book An African American Artistic Production to American history, the Christian tradition, and international modern art movements. Importantly, these traditions became present through the reader's intonations of the poems, the formal intimations of blues and jazz and contemporary imagery. Far from simply fixing something of the old-time preacher, God's Trombones integrated the general 1920 search for a national culture and American essence with the more specific goal of African-American advancement. And with that, I would like to add, comes with it all the challenges of that period, particularly in terms of whether to use dialect or not to use dialect, whether to call on African art or not to call on African art. So I'm not trying to... I realize I'm ending this talk on kind of an upbeat note about this book, because I do think it's quite successful. On the other hand, I also recognize that it leaves a lot of the tensions I've discussed rather unresolved. So I will leave it at that and would love to try and answer your questions or to get your feedback or ideas. So thank you very much for listening.
Kristen, that was a wonderful talk. And I like really your bringing together, you know, the poetry, the illustrations, and the lettering. The question I wanted to ask, though, was a little bit about Johnson's use of these sermons. Now, you kept mentioning that they were antebellum sermons. How did he know about these sermons? I mean, he did not himself live back in the antebellum era. Were these ones that were from newspapers, or were they famous ministers like maybe Henry Tanner, Henry Tanner's father? Were they maybe contemporary? Were some contemporary like Adam Clayton Powell Sr.? Mm-hmm. What were his sources?
That's a great question. And one is... He does call on his own personal experience growing up in the South, that he would have heard these sort of itinerant preachers. Also, there were certainly some published sermons. Interestingly enough, though, of course, the published sermons tend to be those by not the antebellum, well, they were antebellum preachers, but not the folk preachers, but by those like Benjamin Tucker Tanner, who were elite members of what we might call very mainstream black churches. The African Methodist Episcopal Church, for example, was very much an elite black church. So we have those sermons, and so we can glean a general format from those about what the sermons would contain. A lot of this, though, is through, I think, oral tradition and memory, all of which is getting sort of worked out in this period and legitimized. And I'm not quite sure how it's getting legitimized yet. That's one thing I'm very interested in, is these projects where people would just go out and start recording people's memories. Like, how did that become kind of a form of historical evidence that was so trustworthy? So I think it's through a combination of sources. Also, the Jasper Johns was now I'm going to get it confused, so I'm going to skip over that. But his was actually reprinted in dialect. It was so well known. And he was known to have, I mean, he spoke it, I think, on the Senate floor or something in Virginia. So there were some of these preachers that were famous enough and traveled enough to have gained quite a following. There are really kind of two templates, we might say. The one template is the one that he employs, which is this sort of general roving sermon. The other is much more traditional in that you start with a single scriptural text, and then you place it in its historical context and then relate it to contemporary realities. And what happened was certain biblical texts inspired certain kinds of imagery. And so those templates would get told and retold and passed along, and they'd travel with the preacher. So there were two general kind of templates that he was certainly working with. Yes.
I was wondering if you knew to what extent Johnson thought of this book as a script for performance, or if he did public readings of any of the poems?
That's a great question, and I was desperately looking for one, because it is a text that begs to be read. And I'm afraid I don't do it justice. So I was looking for an example of that. There was a CD that was recently republished by the Smithsonian Folkways of a famous actor from the 1950s reading this. However, it was too disappointing for me to bring in. I think I had imagined somebody with a deep, resonant voice, and instead, it's just kind of high, it's too high-pitched and just not very interesting. So I don't know, I haven't been able to find out if he did his own readings. I do know that it was recorded, and then there have been kind of reincarnations of this, where there have been composers who have responded and put this to music and created compositions from it. So it does have a musical afterlife, we might say. But I'm not sure yet to what intent. Another interesting fact is this was published by Viking Press, which was a new press that was really believed that literature had the ability to raise public consciousness and level of debate. And they published this book in particular, along with a lot of others, and heavily publicized it. So there did seem to be some kind of intent behind it. But I haven't learned exactly what that is. Johnson himself doesn't talk about it, and I haven't seen yet the records for Viking Press to know what kind of conversations they had.
Hi, enjoyed the talk. I have a question, or maybe just a general sense of wonder about some of the images of militancy in the pictures. In the foreground, there's often people with weapons, and even so many of the images are sharp, so that leaves kind of look like swords and trees look like they're exploding into flames or edges. When you look back on antebellum sermons, oftentimes they're criticized for being unduly passive, and any sort of subversion that you find in them is in the mode of escape, mm-hmm. as opposed to violent resistance. Is Johnson or Douglas, or any, I mean, even the calligraphy itself has very sharp edges and seems mm-hmm. sort of violent in some ways. Is this a rescripting of that past? Is there some kind of interaction or comment upon militancy?
That's a great question, and I think you're certainly right to point out that there was a real question by African American intellectuals like Du Bois and Johnson himself asking to what degree Christianity really. To what degree it was used to maintain the institution of slavery and to what degree it provided a means to undermine it, for lack of a better word. I hadn't noticed the violence that you mentioned, but I think you're right. And I'm going to propose a completely unsubstantiated suggestion. I don't know the degree to which revelation played a role in a lot of African-American poetry, preaching, and the like. It clearly plays a role here in God's Trombones, and it's emerged, and upon rereading it a couple more times, it begins to emerge again and again and again in very subtle ways. And again, this completely unsubstantiated point is also coming from when you look at Harriet Power's Bible quilts, for example, where revelations also play a role. And then when you look in later, what we might call outsider art, revelation is the primary text, it seems, that many of these artists call on. So what I'm interested in finding out is learning to what degree revelations was perhaps more embedded kind of in the folk tradition than in the kind of the more written tradition that we have access and records of. And if so, I think the more violent imagery, the more dramatic imagery, would certainly have its roots in there. But it's also worth. I'll also want to look at his other work. There isn't quite the violence in this group that yet there is in sort of the Marcus Garvey. In fact, you see a lot of criticisms of Marcus Garvey in The Crisis and some other publications. But it is a really interesting observation that I'll have to look at and consider.
I wondered if it were not so much, or perhaps it is the Book of Revelation, but also a commentary upon the social context of the time, that the violence that was being experienced by African Americans in that period is superimposed on these other images. That would be a visual comment if, in fact, the other was too soft and maybe subversive in too soft a way. This is kind of saying this is what's happening as a contrast to that.
That's another great way to look at it, because there were many African Americans who simply argued that white Christianity was not real Christianity. In fact, it was sort of a bastardized kind, right? And so it was the job of African American Christians to teach Euro-Americans what Christianity was supposed to look like. That's one element. The other element is something that, and I'm not going to remember this scholar's name, and I'm a little bit embarrassed, but one person who has written about these multimedia productions in the Harlem Renaissance has talked about the very fine line that Du Bois walked in the crisis when dealing with issues of lynching. Because if you looked through the crisis, Du Bois knew how to use imagery to his advantage. And the crisis is heavily, heavily illustrated. There's like a baby issue where everyone sends in their pictures of their babies, right? There's the graduation issue where all of the college graduates are depicted in very standard headshots. There are articles in which you go into a leading African-American socialite's home and see how they've designed it. The advertisements are equally instructive and didactic, telling you how you should wear your hair, what you should buy, what colleges you should attend. But Du Bois was also passionate about ending lynching and calling attention to the degree of lynching, and he would use photos over and over and over again. And often he'd use them in different places and contexts. So he was always trying to balance this kind of this positive journal with some of the realities, with the very violent realities of the violent reality of lynching. And so it might be that tension appears. It would be another way to think about the tension in these pieces, not only in competing claims to what Christianity is and should be, but also how it should be interpreted within an African American context, and how to present some of these very difficult issues in a form that should reach, you know, a more general audience.
Two comments, really. It seems to me that what Johnson may be doing with this piece, and I'm speaking here as a homiletician, mm-hmm. is elevating the African-American preacher in a time when he, and I do mean he, is being challenged by societal norms and shifts, and bringing the African-American preacher into a corollary relationship with political leaders and social agencies, so that antebellum sermon acts as a vehicle for reestablishing the role mm-hmm. of the African-American preacher in contemporary society. And the other comment I really want to make is that any number of these sermon motifs or scenarios can be heard in any African-American pulpit in Boston any given Sunday. That mm-hmm. basically what would be interesting would be the analysis of some of these motifs and the whole issue of language and the use of language from Johnson to the contemporary African-American preacher.
First of all, on the second point, I think you're exactly right. And one thing I've noticed when trying to do research on the African-American sermon is just how many of them are very presentist studies, where I keep, you know, as the historian, I keep looking for someone who's going to kind of give me those templates from the 19th century and maybe show me how they change. But most of them are dealing with the homiletic tradition as it is and kind of expounding on it and then showing how it's been altered, changed, and mutated. So it would be very... So if you have any... Basically what I'm doing is begging you for sources and information. The second part is, I think you're also right about sort of resurrecting the preacher as someone who is not a comic figure, right? Because it's very easy to look at these preachers, you know, people would say that they were uneducated, that they didn't know the biblical text, that they spoke in dialect, and therefore they were more comic, when in reality they really were the leaders of the African American community. And I do think he is trying to bring to them the respectability that they had within their communities. I think that's certainly right. And I think what else he's doing, and it's quite interesting, is that spirituals had already become respectable. And it's very interesting because right after you have an advertisement for God's Trombones, and the next page is an advertisement for race records, particularly the spirituals. And in almost every case, what they've done is they've taken kind of images of black musicality from the 19th century that generally depict blacks out in the forest, you know, jumping up and down and singing. And in all these race records, they are now in a church with an organ or sitting in pews. And part of this transition for the spiritual certainly happened because of the, oh man, now it's going to go right, the Jubilee Singers, thank you very much, who were going on concert tours, right, singing the spirituals and putting them into, and there were plenty of composers who were also converting the spirituals to kind of much more well-known orchestrated compositions. And so I think in a way what we have Johnson doing is trying to do the same thing here, trying to bring the preacher up to the status of the spirituals as well accepted and beloved and adored by black and white Americans as a point of pride and as kind of a point of real American identity. And there were plenty of people, Europeans and the like, who were claiming in this period that it was the spirituals that were the American product. They embodied America more than any other product that it produced. So thank you very much for all of your comments. I have a lot of great work to do.
You've been listening to a lecture sponsored by the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts at Boston University. Speaking was 2007 Luce Visiting Assistant Professor Dr. Kristen Schwein. Dr. Swain's lecture was titled Modernity's Usable Past, James Weldon Johnson, Aaron Douglas, and Charles B. Fall's God's Trombones. We began with an introduction by Luce Program Director Peter Hawkins. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog, with help from Matt Odette and Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.